From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. These are the days of fiscal cliff fever. Yesterday was the Republicans' turn to ante up, John Boehner front and center. Many are deeply worried about the American economy and deficit. But there is a liberal view that says don't play too much ball here, Mr. President, that the cliff may be a hustle. This hour, On Point, liberals on the fiscal cliff. You can join the conversation. Who's swaying you? Whose view? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Paul Krugman and more join us in a moment. But first, from Washington, with the latest on the GOP counterproposal, is Lisa Mascaro, congressional correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Lisa, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, you bet. Thanks for having me.
So what's most important to know about what Republicans are offering here, Lisa?
Well, I think 2 points. One, they put a detailed offer on the table, which had been something they needed to do. The Republicans were getting a lot of pressure from Democrats saying, hey, where's the real offer? And two, that the offer doesn't really move the ball. They sort of came in short on a couple of key issues, revenues and then spending cuts, that the White House would like to see. That said, I think now we've got both offers on the table. And, you know, you can sort of start the beginning of the real talks now.
Put them side by side for a second. If for people just tuning into this to say, what's really the difference? Put them side by side. The Tim Geithner's, the president's, and Boehner's, the Republicans.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, last week, Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, came up to the Capitol Hill with the White House proposal, and it was, you know, laughed out of town by Republicans. And sort of the same thing happened yesterday when Speaker Boehner outlined his proposal, and the White House sort of laughed it out of town. I sort of look at these two proposals as almost mirror images of each other. They sort of take their sort of partisan approach to revenues and spending cuts. So, you know, the president is seeking $1.6 trillion over the decade in new revenues. One of the key issues for the president is raising those tax rates on the upper income households, those 2% of American households that are earning, you know, $250,000 and above for couples, $200,000 and above for singles.
Right.
And then he gets additional revenue next year through tax reform. And then he's got about $400 billion in spending cuts. Like I said, mirror opposite. Speaker Boehner yesterday put down half as much revenue and none of it coming this year, nothing to do with the tax rates, everything happening next year through tax reform, a sort of non-starter for Democrats. And then, you know, he's seeking $1.4 trillion. Again, sort of three times as much as the president was seeking in deep cuts to the social safety net. So, you know, they were talking, the Republicans, about, you know, raising the Medicare eligibility age, you know, on seniors, asking wealthier seniors to pay higher premiums for their Medicare, changing the cost of living adjustment for beneficiaries of Social Security so that they would not get as large of a COLA bump each year. These are all ideas that have been out there before. They should be no surprise to anyone. They were discussed during the big bipartisan financial commission a couple years ago and in last year's budget talks. But, you know, these are priorities Democrats will fight hard to protect. And so you saw the White House respond very swiftly with an offer, saying the offer was not, you know, not balanced.
This was John Boehner yesterday, Lisa, saying, look, we're not doing what the president did. We're offering a real offer here, a real deal.
We could have responded in kind, but decided not to do that.
Lisa Mascaro, LA Times, you're saying, no, this is kind of a mirror image of the president's offer, one on this side, one on that side.
There was something that happened yesterday that was sort of critical. The House Republicans could have come back with their budget from last year. So, you know, the president's proposal was essentially his 2013 budget proposal. They could have come back with their proposal, which would have been, you know, the Paul Ryan budget that we all probably remember from the presidential campaign, the changes to Medicare, the new voucher program for the next generation of seniors. And they didn't. And I think that was a really interesting, important point.
What's it mean? Is it a concession, a material?
It was definitely a concession. They acknowledged in their comments and in their letter to the president that the election mattered and that they sort of understood that this was not a starting point. And I think it was an effort by Republicans to show that they were trying to act responsible and put a good faith offer off the table, not some, you know, Speaker Boehner called the president's offer a la-la land offer, you know. So these are all the harsh words floating around. But, you know, I think they were trying to kind of get the upper hand in the debate by showing a realistic offer. Maybe not that happened. But, you know, that was, I think, the intent.
Lisa Mascaro, congressional correspondent with the Los Angeles Times. Lisa, thank you so much for taking a few minutes with us today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Here was Lindsey Graham, Republican senator, on CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday, saying the White House's offer was inadequate, predicting that Washington will not come together to forge a deal.
I think we're going over the cliff. It's pretty clear to me they've made a political calculation. This offer doesn't remotely deal with entitlement reform in a way to save Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security from imminent bankruptcy. It raises $1.6 trillion on job creators that will destroy the economy, and there are no spending controls.
There's Lindsey Graham. We want to talk to liberals on the fiscal cliff today. Joining us now from Princeton, New Jersey, Paul Krugman, columnist at the New York Times, economist at Princeton, author of End This Depression Now. He says, go over the cliff if you need to, Mr. President. Paul Krugman, welcome back to On Point.
Hi there.
Where do you see the state of play here, Paul?
Okay. The first thing I think we need to say, since you just heard a report about the Republican offer, is you really need to look at it closely. It's not, in fact, a detailed proposal. This is a Potemkin proposal. There's very little actual substance in there. So I'm a little depressed to see that reporters are not catching that. It calls for $800 billion in revenue from closing loopholes, but doesn't say anything. Doesn't specify a single loophole that it will close.
The suggestion has been in the commentary around it, Paul, that there will be loopholes that are closed that will bring in revenue from upper income Americans.
Yeah, but what are we talking about here? And if the thing that the loophole that's most often talked about is itemized deductions, and we've done the math on that. You cannot raise $800 billion by limiting itemized deductions unless you either kill charitable deductions, which would be pretty catastrophic for a lot of organizations, or put a lot of the burden on the middle class instead of on the wealthy. So it's a number that's thrown out there, and they want you to think that because they've specified a number, they've actually specified a policy, but they haven't. On the spending cuts, the named policies, which are raising the retirement age, raising the Medicare age,
yep.
Changing the price index, increasing
on Social Security, yep.
All those things amount to about $300 billion over the next 10 years. But they're claiming that they're going to achieve much bigger spending cuts than that. And again, they haven't specified how. So this is just a bunch of magic asterisks. It's a bunch of, you know, policies to be detailed later. It's not a real offer. It's just it's a pretense. So, you know, these are not mirror images. Like it or not, the Obama proposal is quite detailed. It explains exactly how they're going to get that $1.6 trillion in revenue. It explains exactly how they're going to get those $400 billion in Medicare cuts. So there's been nothing comparable on the other side.
In policy terms, it matters to have teeth in a proposal. In political or negotiating terms, what's the significance of this? If you're right, Paul, that there's not enough there.
Well, I think it's not an offer that could be accepted or anything close to it because we don't know what it means. When you say, well, we're for revenue, and since no details have been laid out, there's this question, all right, so how long are we going to take before you give us some details, and what happens to the fiscal cliff in the meantime? Are we going to get an extension of the Bush tax cuts unchanged while you figure out what it is you're proposing? It's not a real negotiating strategy. It's not even a starting point from a negotiation. It's a way of trying to make yourself sound reasonable, but there's nothing to negotiate over because there are no details.
What's the big standoff here, as you see it, Paul? Less than a month ago, you said, go over the cliff if you need to, Mr. President. But,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of people really worried about what that would mean for the economy, for individuals. What's the real standoff?
Yeah. Well, the fiscal cliff is actually many different pieces, but the big standoff, as it's been defined, is the high-end Bush tax cuts. And are we going to, you know, make those perpetual, which I think is pretty clear now that's not going to happen, but the question is exactly how do we go about having it not happen? And the Republican demand for a pound of flesh in return in the form of things like raising the Medicare eligibility age and having presumably somewhere in there they're going to be trying to have savage cuts in Medicaid as part of the story as well. So, although they don't specify that. So the question is basically, what does the president have to give up in order to get those part of the Bush tax cuts to expire?
And the cliff itself, I mean, it's being described, the Financial Times, as our Thelma and Louise moment, you know, in the convertible over the cliff to the crash beyond Armageddon.
Well, it's certainly not. If we had a sane political system, you would not be doing this. I mean, we're still a depressed economy. We're still in a liquidity trap, which means that the Federal Reserve, what that means is that interest rates are near zero. The Federal Reserve can't offset fiscal austerity by cutting interest rates, which mm-hmm. normally do. So this is actually not a time when you'd want to be doing austerity at all. But we have this political dynamic that was created by 4 years of scorched earth opposition to President Obama, and he can't just think, well, what would be the macroeconomically right thing to do here if it means mortgaging the whole future of the U.S. budget.
Are you still ready to see him go over the cliff rather than you are?
Yeah, because I think at this point the political dynamics actually are pretty good. If he goes over the cliff, what most people think, nobody knows for sure, but what most people I talk to think is that if we go over the cliff, then sometime quite soon, probably in January, there is a vote on, because then the Bush tax cuts have all expired. And then there's a vote to reinstate the middle-class Bush tax cuts.
Paul Krugman, hold the thought right there. We've got a break right in front of us. We've got to take it. Paul Krugman, The New York Times, is with us. We're looking at the liberal view of the fiscal cliff. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're this hour hearing the liberal view of the fiscal cliff, what it means, what it doesn't, to the left, what they say to the Republicans' new offer. Paul Krugman of The New York Times has been with us. We'll hear more in just a moment. Here was the House Speaker John Boehner. This was on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace. Wallace asked him what his reaction was when Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner offered up the White House plan last week.
I was just flabbergasted. I looked at him and said, you can't be serious. I've just never seen anything like it. You know, we've got 7 weeks between Election Day and the end of the year. And three of those weeks have been wasted with this nonsense.
Okay, so if they're wasted, where are we now? And quite frankly, what are the chances we're going to end up going over the cliff?
Well, right now, I would say we're nowhere. Period. We're nowhere.
Flabbergasted, nowhere. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner told CNN's Candy Crowley on Sunday, Republicans are going to have to face up to taxing the wealthiest Americans more or no deal.
There's not going to be an agreement without rates going up.
Off the fiscal cliff if the Republicans say, sorry, no way are we going to raise rates for the on the wealthy. You guys are willing to go off the fiscal cliff.
If Republicans are not willing to let rates go back up, and we think they should go back to the Clinton levels, a time when the American economy is doing exceptionally well, then there will not be an agreement.
Timothy Geithner on Sunday. Paul Krugman joins us today from the New York Times. With us right now from Kansas City, Missouri, is Stephanie Kelton, economist at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, founder and editor of the Journal of New Economic Perspectives. Stephanie Kelton, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What do you think ought to happen here? Do you think the cliff is for real? Is it serious? Is it, you know, is it like do anything to avoid it or not?
Well, it certainly seems to be the direction that most of the conversation is headed. It's for real in the sense that if a deal isn't struck to avoid the cliff, we go over the cliff, and a lot of people are going to feel an awful lot of economic pain gratuitously. What I think should happen is probably the least likely thing to happen, which is that we repeal the Budget Control Act. And
that is,
slow
repeal
things.
The cliff, erase it, take it away.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, this is an absolutely manufactured crisis to deal with a phony debt and deficit crisis, and everybody's in a state of panic. And when you're in a state of panic, you tend to make the least sensible decisions. So there's absolutely no sense of urgency. We ought to repeal the Budget Control Act. We ought to slow things down and stop and start getting the policy right for a change.
What do you mean it's a phony debt and deficit crisis? I mean, a lot of Americans, and you may say they've just been buffaloed or stampeded, but, you know, do the polls, a lot of Americans are worried about the deficit.
Well, sure they are, because both sides, and to be fair, it's mainly the Petersons of the world and many on the right have
deficit hawks
done
there.
The deficit hawks, and they have done such a fantastic job of convincing ordinary Americans that the U.S. is just a footstep behind Greece, and that if we don't begin to adopt the same sorts of austerity policies that have so damaged so many European countries, that we're going to end up like them. And so the irony, of course, is that if we were to do the kinds of things that they've been doing, we would in fact end up like them. And what that means is going back into recession, watching unemployment rates increase, watching growth rates decline, and by the way, watching deficits and debt get bigger, not smaller. And
But isn't there an element of desperation here? I mean, people have watched deficits go up and up, and they're thinking, well, okay, we've got a crisis. Maybe we can turn it into an opportunity. Let's use this to put the brakes on. You know, at last, here's a way, here's a reason, here's a moment.
Yeah, but again, we're saying deficits are too big, the debt is too big, mm-hmm. and therefore we need fiscal austerity. And we've seen the way that's working in these countries that have tried it. Their deficits are getting bigger, not smaller. Their debts are growing, not shrinking. We are so preoccupied with the numerator. In other words, it's always about the deficit to GDP ratio or the debt to GDP ratio. Everybody focuses on the numerator, the size of the deficit, the size of the debt, forgetting that if the denominator, GDP, grows, those ratios come down really quickly. And so look, what happened during the mid to late 1990s and into the early part of 2000? The economy grew rapidly. Unemployment shrunk to 3.7%, official unemployment rates. The economy was growing robustly. And what happened to the deficit? It completely disappeared. So you didn't have to actively try to rein the deficit in. All you had to do was have an economy that was growing and producing jobs, and the deficit takes care of itself.
Paul Krugman's been saying this very loudly. He's saying it in his latest book, End This Depression Now. The president's got something like $50 billion for infrastructure in his proposal that came out last week. Is that the kind of thing you're looking for, more stimulus? And what about the people who say, well, that didn't work in the last 4 years?
Well, the people who say it didn't work are just absolutely wrong. I mean, the evidence is overwhelmingly strong. You look at any number of indicators, and there are improvements across the board in response in the immediate aftermath of
kept us from collapse, but nobody's happy with the employment rate where it is now, with the growth rate where it is now?
Right. Clearly, with 23 million Americans who want full-time work and can't find it, we are nowhere near running up against the kind of constraints in the real economy that would prevent us from putting resources to use, employing people, producing more. And so what Professor Krugman's been calling for so long is exactly the right kind of thing, in my view. We've got manufacturing workers and construction workers who are still out of work. We've got an infrastructure deficit in this country on the order of $2.2 trillion. We have lots of useful things for people to do, and we have unemployed people with exactly the kinds of skills that it takes to do those sorts of improvements in terms of infrastructure. So it seems like a no-brainer.
Would you go beyond the White House then with its $50 billion in infrastructure spending? Would you do more than that?
Sure. $50 billion is a tiny drop in the bucket when it's compared to a $2.2 trillion infrastructure shortfall. And I'm just talking about what the Corps of Engineers says we need to spend just to bring our existing infrastructure up to snuff. I mean, it is absolutely an embarrassment, and it's dangerous as well.
Stephanie, stand by in Kansas City. Paul Krugman, you may have people nodding along, but you're going to have a lot of others, and you know this from the feedback you must get, just shaking their head and saying, wait a minute, I thought we had a debt crisis here. We've got to solve it. Here's Stephanie talking not just $50 billion, but $2 trillion in spending that ought to be done, and here we've got all this debt already.
Well, yeah, and that's because, as Stephanie said, the Pete Petersons of the world have done a very good job of selling these scare stories. One thing I would just want to add on all of this is that we got these deficits as if it were some kind of impersonal process or both sides did it. And the fact of the matter is we were running a budget surplus at the end of the 1990s.
Famously.
And then George W. Bush rammed through a tax cut saying the fact that the government is running a surplus means that it's taking too much of your money and we need to give it back to you. And now we're proposing that, hey, you know, maybe that tax cut wasn't a good idea and we should undo it. They say, oh, no, we can't do that. Instead, we have to raise the age of eligibility for Medicare. So you have to keep in mind that, first of all, this was a partisan thing and that it's a bait and switch. And, yes, I mean, on terms of the economy, this is not the time to be worrying about deficits. The only reason, I think, for the president to be worrying about it is that he does have to establish a position. He's got a maximum point of bargaining power right now, and he has to use it. But it's crazy, the way that we created this crisis out of thin air. When the U.S. government, bear in mind, the U.S. government is able to borrow at just about the lowest interest rates in history. It's able to sell inflation-protected bonds at negative interest rates. People are paying the U.S. government to take their money. The idea that we should be obsessed with the deficit right now is just insane.
Boy, you can just get whiplash listening to these two perspectives. They are so far apart. Let's get our listeners in here. Paul Krugman, Stephanie Kelton, stand by. Bud's calling from New York, Cranberry Lake, New York. Hi, Bud. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
You're welcome. My feeling is very, very strongly toward let's go right over the gosh darn cliff. My wife and I are both children of the Great Depression. I remember very clearly $4,000 houses that my father-in-law purchased. My dad had a very nice home, their first home, for $4,000. The whole thing to be learned, Tom, I think, from the Great Depression is favor the saver. I am very critical of Mr. Bernanke and his leadership as far as interest rates are concerned. 12-month CDs selling for 0.5%.
But when you say go over the cliff, Bud, do you mean then just let all those cuts and tax hikes go into effect? Just bite the bullet? Is that your recipe?
Absolutely. We must learn how to live within our means. This is true of the average citizen in this country. I'm amazed at the leadership that is coming out of Washington and from the chairman of the Fed, which is spend, spend, spend.
Both of my guests today, Bud, so far say we need to spend now to rebuild infrastructure that's falling apart. It's a cheap time to borrow. It's a good time to invest to restart the economy. What do you say?
I think the economy will restart itself. There are so many floors for the unemployed that we're creating a culture of people who really don't want to work. To work in my generation was a wonderful privilege. When you got a job, whether you graduated from college or not, it was a thing to be very proud of.
Bud, let me take that right to Paul Krugman. Paul, there's the child of the Great Depression, and
yeah,
you know, you're right up against his view of the world at this point.
Yeah, so there's a lot of things I would say. By the way, if you know unemployed people, and I do, I think we all must, the notion that they're unemployed because they don't want to work is awesome, and if I may say, cruel. It's that all the unemployed people I know are desperate for jobs. They will take anything, and there just are no jobs to be had. It's a very, very difficult situation. And the crucial thing to understand about times like this is that we can't all spend less than our income. My spending is your income. Your spending is my income. If both of us try to spend less than our income, the result is that we get into a depression. Somebody has to spend out there. The economy is not an individual household. The economy is a collective enterprise of many different people. And what the economy is suffering from right now is not enough demand.
But you hear Bud, he says he's not buying it anymore. He says we just got to bite the bullet, clean up our balance sheet here, and sort of restart.
Well, that's what a lot of countries tried to do in the 1930s, and they just went deeper and deeper into the Depression. What actually brought us out of the Depression, by the way, was an enormous spending program, enormous fiscal stimulus called World War II. It was actually a lot of borrowing and spending by the federal government that ended the Great Depression. So the lessons of the Depression are exactly the opposite of what Bud's saying. The lessons of the Depression are, at times like these, you need to have the government step in there and serve as the spender of last resort.
Paul Krugman, Stephanie Kelton, please stand by. With us right now from Washington is Stan Collender. He's a Known as a Washington budget guru, writes the weekly column Fiscal Fitness for Roll Call, National Director of Financial Communications at Corvus. He worked on the House and Senate Budget Committee for the House Ways and Means Committee, served on President Clinton's Capital Budget Commission. Stan Collender, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Did you really just call me a guru?
You got guru'd. You'll have to deal with that. Listen, here's Paul and Stephanie, and they're saying, you know, this cliff is a created crisis, and maybe we should just blow right through it. Maybe we should be spending more, not less. But then you hear our child of the Depression, Bud, call in and say, wait a minute, clean up your household. And I'm looking at polls here from people who voted for President Obama saying, you know, 41% want to get control of the deficit mainly by cutting spending. Another 41% want to solve it mainly with tax increases and some spending. You know, 8 in 10 saying compromise, get an agreement on fixing the deficit. So what's the path here, Stan?
This is actually not that difficult. And let me agree with both Paul and Stephanie here. The austerity program that the fiscal cliff would put in place, $600 billion in deficit reductions or withdrawing economic activity from the economy, would be coming at a time when the economy can't handle it. In fact, it would be the worst fiscal policy put in place in the United States since the end of the Great Depression, when we put an austerity program in place before the economy could handle it and threw the economy back into a recession too quickly. And as Paul suggested a few minutes ago, it was only World War II that got us out of that. Having said that, there are two things that are pretty important to say here. One, if this is not the right time to reduce the deficit or to reduce the debt as a percent of GDP, as Stephanie was talking about, then that doesn't mean there's never a time. It just means that when corporations are hoarding cash, when consumers aren't spending, when state and local governments are cutting back, and when trade is not helping, those are all the other four elements of GDP, then this is not the right time for the federal government to be withdrawing or reducing economic activity as well. So the path here is simple. A bad deal on the fiscal cliff that imposes austerity is worse than the fiscal cliff itself. But if we can put in place a process that will allow us to think about this at the right time or to implement a process at the a deficit reduction or debt to GDP ratio reduction at the right time, and that could be a year from now, it could be a little bit longer, who knows, then that's the right way to do it. I can tell you, for everyone who's saying that they're frustrated and angry about federal spending, they will be as angry about the government pushing the economy back into a recession, at least as angry, if not worse, than they are about anything having to do with spending. And they will beg for the government to take some sort of activity to fix it.
Do you see Republicans and Democrats anywhere near a kind of agreement that would say, okay, we'll do X, Y, or Z right now, and then we'll fix the whole thing in a year or whatever that may be? Or are we still, as Lindsey Graham says, headed over the cliff, as Paul Krugman says, maybe we should be?
Well, I've been telling clients for 4 months that I thought we were heading over the cliff, and nothing that's happened in since Election Day has changed my mind about that. The one thing I disagree with that I've heard a lot of reports about over the last 3 or 4 or 5 days, I guess, since Timothy Geithner was up on Capitol Hill revealing the administration's initial proposal, the one thing I disagree with is that the talks are stalemated. The talks aren't stalemated because they haven't started yet. And that's important to understand here. I mean, all we've got is the equivalent of alpha males pounding their chest, circling each other, trying to exert their territoriality. This is what's going on now is the equivalent of what happened at the beginning of the Vietnam peace talks, where they spent months deciding the shape of the table about which the talk should happen.
You say it's easy, though, and I'm not sure that it is easy at all, that there's anything that's going to be agreed on here.
Well, no, I didn't say – I don't think I used the word easy at all, but I'm pretty sure that – it'll be a lot easier after January 1 to get everyone to come to their senses than it will be to do it before and try to position themselves, maneuver for political positioning.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're hearing the liberal view of the fiscal cliff today, what it means, what it doesn't, to the left what they say, to the Republicans' new offer. Paul Krugman of the New York Times is here. Stephanie Kelton is with us from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and a new economic perspective. Stan Collender is here from Washington, follows the budget there at Fiscal Fitness, and for years wrote the Budget Battles column for the National Journal. Let's go to Josh in Richmond, Vermont. Josh, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make two points I talked to your screener about, and then while I was listening, I thought of a third thing I'd like to mention. So the first is in line with what Paul Krugman said about bait and switch, and one of you called a created crisis. I heard this thing on a talk show a while ago called the fiscal bluff, and that seems like a more appropriate title for this. My second point is...
Why a bluff? Everybody agrees there's real pain on the other side of it, right? You've got real spending cuts, real tax hikes for everybody.
I don't know if it's hard to know if it's real or not, because you can listen to different people, and some of us will, you know, some will say it's real pain and some will say it's not. But it's certainly a bluff in the metaphorical sense that I think, anyway, that this is a created crisis. My second point is that the Republicans seem to be very concerned about tax hikes for the top 2%. But I'm afraid that if the stock market reacts in a bad way to what might happen, the top 2% is going to lose a lot more in their decrease in their investment values than any tax hike would.
What does that mean? Do you think they'll be on the phone to Republican leadership in Congress saying, do whatever it takes to avoid this cliff, or they're just going to feel the pain too?
I don't know. Well, I'm sure they're on the phone to Republican leaders in Congress right now. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But it seems like we're just ignoring what could happen to this. And not that I'm worried about the top 2% and their taxes, but just that we seem a little bit short-sighted to say, you know, the Republicans say, well, we don't want the taxes to go up for our people. But I think their people could lose a lot more if the market goes down.
True, though that could be economic pain for a lot of people. Josh, let me hold those and get one more, if I may. Galena, Illinois. John's on the air. John, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm a Republican, so I'm going to kind of play devil's advocate here.
Let's hear it.
Okay, so I think it's in Obama's best interest to actually go over the cliff. I wouldn't like to see the cliff happen, but it's in Obama's best interest, because if we go over the fiscal cliff, he gets the tax raises, and he gets to cut military spending. And then if we do go into a recession, he can push the political fallout onto the Republicans not cooperating.
Right. So you're a Republican, really, but you think he may well want to do it. But that, what if, you know that on the other side of that cliff, John, everybody's taxes go up, including the middle class that the president talked so much during the campaign about protecting. What about that?
Well, the middle class-wise, if the higher taxes bring in more revenue and it lowers the debt, then it should, according to Obama's policies and what he thinks, if the government can push more money in because of higher tax revenue, then it would fix the economy anyway.
So maybe he's in the catbird seat there. I don't know. Paul, what about it? I mean, part of the assumption in when you say, Mr. President, let it happen if you need to, aren't you assuming, Paul Krugman, that Congress would, on the other side of the fiscal cliff, the other side of January 1st, come back and cut taxes for middle-income Americans and lower-income Americans again? Aren't you presuming that, Paul? Are you sure would happen?
Of course, there's no certainty in life, but yeah. I mean, after we go over the cliff, then Democrats can demand a vote on lowering middle-class taxes back to where they were in 2012. Very hard for Republicans to vote against that. So they actually are in a politically much stronger position. Now, if the Republicans balk at that, which most people I talk to don't think that will happen, but if they do, even so, there's this question, can you allow government by blackmail? Can you, in the end, if the opposition party is going to constantly try to get its way by threatening to bring the economy to a screeching halt, basically, we'll blow up this whole place if you don't give me what I want.
Yeah, but Democrats helped build the fiscal cliff, right? This was a bipartisan solution.
Well, actually, the fiscal cliff was created over a confrontation over a previous fiscal cliff at the end of 2010, and then also over the debt ceiling. Both basically blackmail situations. There, at some point, you have to say no. Look, at this, you don't get to do that. If you can pass legislation, you can pass legislation. You don't get to get your way in politics by threatening to destroy the U.S. economy.
Stan Cullen, do Democrats have that much leverage on the other side of the fiscal cliff? Maybe the Republicans will come back and say, no, we're not going to cut taxes just for the middle class. We're going to reinstate the Bush tax cuts for everybody. Take it or leave it. We've got the House of Representatives.
Yeah, well, and boy, where do we start with that? Number one, it looks as if you look at any of the current polling on this, is that Republicans will take the majority of the blame if we go over the cliff. That's what the polling shows. And I want to remind everybody just a little history. In 95 and 96, when it was Gingrich versus Clinton, and there were two government shutdowns, the Republicans really took it on the chin politically there. In fact, in many people believe that was the beginning of the end of Gingrich's speakership, and there's a lot of concern that it would happen again here. I think we all have to stop thinking about this as rationally as we've been discussing it for the last 45 minutes or so. This is as much a political as it is an economic situation. I think Paul is correct. Would Republicans really risk being blamed for what could be, and what the Congressional Budget Office says would be, throwing the economy back into a recession? And that's what would happen if the fiscal cliff hits and all the policies stay in effect. Would they lose their ability to say that they were the party of tax cuts? I think all of that's correct. You've got to understand two things. Number one, Democrats think that they've never had as much leverage over Republicans, political leverage, as they have now or they're going to have now. And second, House Republicans are saying that they are the last bastion of Republican power in Washington. They will stay in the majority in the House as long as they don't raise taxes. So you put all that together and you realize the rationality we've been discussing, the economics of the situation we've been discussing, may not, probably aren't, at least through January 1, the controlling factor
here. But put it all in the gut then. And, just look at it that way. If there's recession again, aren't people going to be pretty unhappy with Democrats too, with President Obama too? If the Republicans say the only way we're going to let up on this is to bring back all the Bush tax cuts, maybe the Democrats would cry uncle.
Maybe. And, as Paul just said a few minutes ago, I mean, there are no guarantees in life here. But again, you go with the polling, you go with the research you've actually done, and it looks like the Democrats are going to and the president will do relatively better than the Republicans will. Look, both suffered greatly last August when we had the debt ceiling debacle, but the Republicans suffered more. So you give that history that Republicans were still held responsible for the debt ceiling debacle, and the poll showing they're continuing to be held here. If I were a Republican, particularly a House Republican, I'd be pretty nervous right now about this situation, and that's why some are starting to talk about breaking the no tax pledge, the Norquist pledge, because it doesn't make any sense to them. Even some of the big name Republicans in the party, the big advisors, have said, why are we defending the top 2%? Let's just move on with life.
Let's go to Nancy in Somerset, Kentucky. Nancy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. My feeling is that the right wing is using the deficit as a club against the majority of people in this country, that they care nothing for the majority of the people of this country's children and grandchildren, only about their own, and that otherwise they would not be trying to cut Medicaid, which is number one thing for poor people. And I can go on and on with my feeling is the deficit is a club that is being used against us and is not important to what has to happen, which is what everybody else has been saying.
Deficit as a club. Okay, we'll look at that over the head of the middle class. Janine in Homestead, Iowa. Janine, you're on the air.
I think that instead of just going over the cliff, that everyone should fight their way to the cliff and jump over gleefully before anyone can stop you. Because it's the only way that we're going to get a cut in defense. It's the only way that the House whack jobs are going to be willing to negotiate. And unlike your other people, I think the deficit is important. Everyone should pay more taxes because having debt hanging around our neck is going to impede economic growth. And this idea that, the small businesses will be hurt. I'm a small business woman, a farmer. Don't you understand that businesses, large and small, do not pay taxes on their gross income? They get to subtract all of their business expenses and anything else that they can think of because they probably won't be audited. And then on what's left, they pay taxes.
Janine, let me ask you, though. I mean, you're a fierce cliff diver. You say fight your way to the cliff and jump off. But you're also really strong on wanting to bring the debt down. So how do you hear when Paul Krugman and Stephanie and others say, don't worry about the debt. Now we need to spend to get this economy going, get the denominator up, not the numerator.
Well, they're partly right. You see, they're looking at it from the big business way of doing things. If you don't have any money, you fire everybody. That's not the kind of austerity we need. What we do is we cut defense and stop the giveaways to big business and the rich people, the bloody parasites, and start hiring people. Hire more teachers, hire more firemen, start building roads, fix the everything that needs to be fixed.
Janine, we've got it. Good luck with the farm there, and I appreciate your call. Stephanie Kelton, what about the idea that's floating through here? I mean, you've got these, you know, you and Paul are saying spend, we need to spend, but you can hear there is a kind of a grassroots desire to get that debt and deficit down to, or a feeling that there's some kind of handle on it. What about a grand bargain at some point in here that would put some brakes on that at the same time as you, I don't know, can you do that and do what you're calling for at the same time?
No, you can't. A grand bargain is just a different type of austerity. It's this whole argument is about on whose backs should we begin to balance the federal budget. That's what this whole debate is about. The question no one's asking is, why are we trying to balance the government's budget at this point in the first place? And Janine had some very good instincts, although she seemed to be struggling with a concern about, you know, debt.
Yeah, a lot of people do.
As a problem. But at the same time, she's saying we ought to be spending to hire teachers and firefighters and help build our infrastructure and so forth. And so her instincts, I think, are good, although she's confused because we seem to have this idea that, you know, if I've got to pay down my debt, I can't, you know, I can't shoulder growing debt burdens as a member of a household or as
sure.
a small business owner. And so surely the federal government has to behave the way I do.
Grover Norquist looks at that and says we're going to end up somewhere between California and Greece. People do know that debt can take even state institutions, you know, nations into real trouble, Stephanie.
Yeah. And look, they're absolutely right. And in the same way that it can take me into real trouble and it can take a small business or a municipality into trouble. And Professor Krugman's done a great job writing about this in a series of columns mm-hmm. just within the last couple of weeks. And he has pointed out something that's really, really crucial to understand when you're thinking about whether debt is going to be a problem. If you're the user of the currency, which I am, which Janine is, mm-hmm. which Greece
All
is,
of us.
Which
mm-hmm.
every state in the U.S. is, if you're the user of the currency, then you've got to be really, really careful about your budget, and you've got to keep your spending in line with your income. If, in contrast, you're the issuer of the currency, the way the U.S. federal government is and Japan and the U.K. are, then you have fiscal space. You have a degree of freedom that just isn't available to everybody else. You can spend counter-cyclically. You can spend even as your income goes down, even as your tax receipts
yep.
go down, because the currency comes from you. The U.S. dollar comes from the U.S. government. It doesn't come from China. And so the federal government can help support incomes, which is what Janine was talking about. Businesses need sales.
I mean, not from China, but we're borrowing plenty. If I may take it to Paul, Newt Gingrich says, among others, he says, he calls the fiscal cliff, this was on Fox News with Greta Van Susteren, and he says the fiscal cliff is an artificial invention of Washington. This is Gingrich. But he's saying instead of fighting over it, let's break it down into pieces, a series of steps that can be taken without having to get rushed into one gigantic, last-minute, little-understood, one-vote, up-or-down package. Is there some kind of a common ground there, Paul? Is there a grand bargain in here somewhere that everybody could get on board with somehow?
No. It really comes down to just look at those two proposals that are out there. The president wants to raise taxes on the top 2%
mm-hmm.
and do some more spending on things that help ordinary Americans. The Republicans want to not raise taxes. In fact, they want to lower tax rates, and they want to cut back sharply on Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. This is a confrontation. I mean, it's class warfare, basically. The two parties are representing extremely different interests. The idea that, if we only get in a room and negotiate like grown-ups, we can negotiate a grand bargain to solve this problem once and for all is just naive.
So go for the win, you say. Take the cliff, bargain on the other side.
No, and the point is we're not actually going to solve the budget problem right now. What we're going to do is we're going to get maybe a step to towards reducing long-run deficits and a step towards not destroying the economy right now. And it's in the interests of President Obama, who has the upper hand in these negotiations, to ensure that the deal we get to do that is as favorable to his point of view as possible. The idea that we should use this moment to try and settle the whole thing once and for all is just, you know, if you've been asleep for the last 20 years and not paying attention to American politics, you might think it's possible, but not really.
Stan, deal, no deal, over the cliff, what do you foresee?
I think we've got, at this point, a 60% chance of going over the cliff and then doing a bungee jump. That is, shortly after the cliff, we'll probably postpone, mitigate, cancel, delay, or otherwise reschedule most of the tax increases and all of the spending cuts that were expected to go into effect as part of the fiscal cliff. And then we'll go through this several other times during the year with the debt ceiling fight and God knows what else. This is not going away anytime soon.
Boy, I feel dizzy. Stan Cullender, thank you very much for being with us from Washington, Stan. Stephanie Kelton at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Paul Krugman at the New York Times, author of End This Depression Now. Thanks to all three of you. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, you're very, very welcome. Listeners, tomorrow we're going to look at the move among some big powers to chop up the global internet, put nations in charge. Russia is very interested in this. China is very interested in this. They're meeting right now in the Middle East. The big push to rein in the web. Join us for that conversation. And you can continue today's conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, or follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We are always happy to hear from you. Some great conversations going on there. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.